Okay. Just excuse my voice today, sorry. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan, Naphtali, and Gad, and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly, and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies and fight against us and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labour, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked with them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labour in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labour, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly.
You say we're beginning this week a series of preaching, and it's on the theme of liberation, based on the story of the Exodus. And the Exodus is a pivotal event in the Bible. And throughout the Old Testament, from that time onwards, we find references to that time in history when God saved his people from slavery in Egypt and brought them into freedom and eventually brought them into the promised land. And Jews still mark the Exodus in their calendar and their Passover celebration. And now throughout the New Testament, we find references to or imagery from the Exodus, now reinterpreted in the light, as they did with the song, in the light of the coming and work of Jesus Christ, the ultimate example of one sent by God to set his people free. Now, for many of us, I guess, as Christians, the Exodus event has lost a lot of its power, a lot of its significance. But if we were to go to the persecuted church, or groups of Christians living under oppression or disadvantage, and we'll see a different picture. Example, the Pentecostal church has its roots in the black community of early 20th century America. In that church, the Exodus still is a potent image. And of course, if you remember the song by Bob Marley, you know, Exodus, movement of Jah people, we see it in Rastafarianism, also has its roots in the same culture, black culture, but it's gone, of course, a very different way. But for those of us who aren't part of a persecuted church or a persecuted people, if the Exodus just becomes a part of ancient history, just something that happened, well, 1700 years ago or something, that's a tragedy, because the Exodus tells us so much about human nature, about God's nature, and about the partnership we have with God in shaping our own lives and shaping the world around us. And we still find ourselves as people in need of liberation, and we still find God, the unchanging God, to be the great liberator. And our preaching is going to be based on the first 19 chapters of Exodus, which see the children of Israel taken out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, to their encounter with Yahweh, the living God, on Mount Sinai. So if you want an overview and you have the time, read the first 19 chapters of Exodus as a block and immerse yourself in this amazing story. Today we're starting at the beginning of the story, but of course it's not the beginning, because we saw immediately from these first few verses of Exodus that the Exodus events don't come out of nowhere. These verses put it firmly in historical context, and straight away from just this little introduction setting the scene, we see two important things. Firstly, we see the fulfillment of God's promise. Because in Genesis 12, God has said to Abraham, I will make you a great nation. In Genesis 15, God tells him that his descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky. And now, in Exodus 1, we meet those descendants, now called the Israelites, after Abraham's grandson, Jacob, to whom God gave the name Israel. And there are loads of them. We're told that the land of Egypt was filled with them. Like God said, your descendants are going to be like dust. They'll be everywhere. Certainly in my house. No, I mustn't. So that reflects badly on my wife, maybe, but... We share the jobs in my house, so I take responsibility. Jen does the passing on quickly, and good thing she's upstairs in GG3. But you know, got myself into a that'll teach me to depart from my notes. From the 70 descendants of Abraham who left Canaan some 400 years before, there are now enough to be a nation in their own right. Exodus 12 records that about 600,000 adult male Israelites left Egypt. And plus we can assume the same number of women and children as well. Probably maybe as many as up to 2 million Israelites were living in Egypt before the Exodus. Now, I'm not a statistician and I'm not a population expert, but I did a fun thing. I thought I'll look up the population of Britain in the year 1600. And it's estimated, they reckon, it was about 5 million. So in 400 years, the population of Britain has increased by about 12 times. We have about 60 million from 5 million. In the same sort of time period, 400 years in Egypt, the Israelites grew from 70 to 2 million. Not as we've grown by 12 times, but grown by 28,000 times. The Israelites had an amazing period of growth. Even if someone comes up to me afterwards and says, you worked that out wrong, it's still an amazing period of growth in those 400 years. You know, if we'd done that, we wouldn't be able to move. Now, whenever the Bible skips over a period of time, we can fairly safely assume that nothing very noteworthy happened during that time. Otherwise, it would have been recorded. There is a 400-year gap in biblical history between the end of Genesis and the start of Exodus, just as there's another 400-year gap between the last book of the Old Testament and the start of the New Testament. And so we can assume that God did nothing spectacular or dramatic during those periods, nothing to write home about, you might say. And sometimes we experience times in our lives when God doesn't seem to be doing anything very dramatic. And that can be frustrating, especially when we know from Scripture and from testimony of other people, sometimes from our own personal experience, that God is able to do much, much more. But the message of Exodus 1 is that during those times when God seems to be absent, he is in fact working in the background. For 400 years, God worked in an unspectacular way, protecting and growing his people in Egypt, so that his purpose and his promise would be fulfilled. And you might not see God doing anything very spectacular in your life right now, but you can be sure that he's working in the background. Jesus said, my Father is always at his work. And so it's okay to long for more evidence of God's activity, so long as we always remember that he is always at work in our lives. We mustn't fall for the devil's lie that God has forgotten about us or he's lost interest in us just because we're not seeing the spectacular. The truth is God is always at work in the background. One day we will see what he was doing if we keep faith with him. God's ultimate purpose for our lives is to grow us in maturity of faith and love. And if we cooperate with what he's doing, then that's just what will happen. That is exactly what will happen through everything that happens to us. If we cooperate with God, we will grow in faith and love. John Wesley, one of my heroes, he corresponded. He wasn't just an evangelist, just a preacher. He corresponded massively with many of the early Methodists, and he kept all the letters. And Now they're collected into huge volumes. They had them in the college library where I was at. And during my degree study, I came across one letter. I particularly liked it. It was to a lady, and she was troubled because she wasn't feeling the same sense of assurance. You know, she didn't have that feeling of safety in God, you know, that God had definitely saved her, that Wesley believed that Christians could have in their lives. And she saw God doing it in other people's lives, but not in hers. And Wesley, I think this is a wonderful, wise word. He told her this: "You have received the Spirit of grace. Without being pained for what you have not, you have cause to bless God for what you have, and to wait patiently till he gives the rest by revealing his Son in your heart." So today, do you have that faith that God will give you what you need when you need it? Do you have eyes to see what he's doing in the background, in a quiet way, in your life? Exodus 1 shows us that God was at work during the silent time, fulfilling his promise to his servant Abraham, and he's still a promise-keeping God. He's promised to be with us always, and he always is. Secondly, we see the fulfillment of prophecy. Now, not only do the events of Exodus 1 fit into a historical context, they turn out not to be random events. Because hundreds of years before, in Genesis 15, we read this: "As the sun was setting, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, 'Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions.'" Now, prophecy is a very mysterious thing, isn't it? Often leaves more questions than answers. And the biggest question for me in that prophecy is, if God says something is going to happen, does that mean that he wants it to happen? In this case, did God cause the Egyptians to mistreat God's people? You know, it rather glosses over the hardship of the Israelites in this passage. But if we could just imagine for a minute, you know, they're slaves, they're treated ruthlessly. You know, I mean, we don't really have an idea, I don't suppose, of how that would feel. But, you know, this is not a trivial thing that happened to God's people. Did God cause the Egyptians to mistreat his people? Or was God telling Abraham about a situation that he knew was going to happen, but which God disapproved of? We can tie ourselves in knots with questions like that, and they open up the bigger questions of whether everything that happens is according to God's plan and purpose. You know, is God's will always done on earth as it is in heaven? And I was thinking, you know, leaving aside these huge questions of whether or not murder, famine, rape, disease can ever be the will of a God whose name is love, I thought, let's just use basic logic. As long as we're praying the Lord's Prayer, asking, "Thy will be done," I suggest that we are saying that this is still a future hope. When Christ returns and everything is put right in a new heaven and a new earth, we won't be praying the Lord's Prayer anymore. We won't have to say, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." But for now, the Lord's Prayer shows us that God's will can be done on earth, but isn't always done on earth. We're not praying for something that's impossible, but we're not praying for something that's a foregone conclusion. Many things happen in this world and in our lives that are not God's will. He wouldn't have wanted them to happen. They're the product of his original gift of free will and creation's abuse of that gift in rebelling against his will. But at the same time, we have to say that the God of the universe is a sovereign God. And we had that in that song, didn't we? The glory of the king, the splendor of the king, about the sovereignty of God. When Job finally caught sight of God's true nature, he told God what he now understood: "I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted." And so we have to acknowledge that things aren't out of God's control. Everything that happens has been permitted by God, even if it hasn't got God's approval. And we can go further, because the message of the Bible is of a God who takes the events of history and the events of our lives and weaves them together in order to work his purpose out. And in the Exodus, the bottom line is that God brings his people out of slavery into the promised land. And it's not difficult to build a case for saying that the whole event was part of God's plan to build them into a great nation. Just think, remember, 400 years before, Abraham's descendants, Jacob and his sons, lived in the promised land. They lived in Canaan. But they weren't a nation. They were just a large family, about 70 people. What would have happened if they'd stayed there, people speculate? Maybe they would have intermarried with some of the Canaanites and their distinctive identity would have gradually been lost. In fact, it was already happening. Judah did marry a Canaanite woman. But we know that that famine forced them to go far away, down into Egypt, looking for food, and they found their brother there, who God had sent ahead of them to prepare the way. Now, the children of Israel are in a totally alien environment. Think, a people with a nomadic background. They're nomadic, aren't they? Abraham and his descendants, herdsmen. You know, they're plonked down in the middle of a sophisticated culture, royalty, hierarchy, a culture so advanced that it could prepare for famine lasting many years. You know, isn't it always the case that people taken far from their home and far from their own culture tend to stick together? You see the principle in operation all around the world, don't you? Wealthy British bankers in Hong Kong, you know, oil workers in Dubai all have their little pet clubs. The Golden Lion Pub in Marbella. Yeah, we like that. It's not always an attractive thing, maybe, but it's always there. People feeling more at home with others who share their language and their cultural norms. And then there's the persecution. There's nothing like persecution to bring people together. Sometimes observed that the reason the church in Europe and North America is so fragmented, so unfocused, in many cases so uncommitted, is that we just have it too easy as followers of Jesus. You know, go to Africa, where most people lack any of the distractions of wealth. Go to China or Islamic nations, where the church is persecuted and it's dangerous to be a Christian, and you see a more committed, a more united church. And you see a church that sees more of the power of God in operations, in miracle and wonder. And in that alien culture, the Israelites retained their identity so well that 400 years later, they still stood out from the Egyptians they lived among so much that Pharaoh found them a threat. And by singling out the Israelites for persecution, he only brought them further together, because that's human nature. And so as we'll see, also, according to the prophecy, we won't go into it now, the circumstances, but the prophecy came true that when they left with great possessions. They left with huge wealth. Because of their time away from the promised land, the children of Israel ended up with enough wealth to build a great nation on. If the whole Exodus event, from leaving Canaan, the 400 years and the 40 years, and then the return to Canaan, including persecution under Pharaoh, was God's idea, then we have to say it worked amazingly well. Not amazing, we have an amazing God. Let's say supremely well. It worked. It was a plan beyond, you know, par excellence, because the Jewish people remain distinctive to this day. They've even survived nearly a 1900-year dispersal around the world, away from their promised land. Are we getting a picture of the God maybe described in Isaiah 55, whose thoughts are above our thoughts and whose ways are above our ways? Are we getting a picture of the God who Romans 8 says, in all things works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. I hope we are getting a picture of that God, because this is the God of the Exodus and the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the God who moved in unfathomable cleverness and incomparable power to release his people from slavery and lead them into the promised land, is our God too. We are the servants, yes, and the sons of God and daughters of God, not just any local deity, but of Almighty God. He is still mighty to save. And this morning, is your spirit stirring within you at the thought of this amazing God who has his hand on your life? And as we go through the events of the Exodus, the question is, will you let the Spirit of God inspire you to trust God more? And will you let him guide you on a journey into a fuller grasp of the freedom he desires for all his people? Amen.